B-Pod Studios.
Stay with us and we're going to show you how to take dead aim.
Take dead aim.
The importance of taking dead aim.
Welcome to Taking Dead Aim, a show dedicated to the game of golf and the people who play it in the Carolinas and around the world. Taking Dead Aim is a presentation of RBC Wealth Management and Academy Sports and Outdoors. And now, here's your host, the man talking in your backswing, Charlie Nance.
Hey there, once again, we are Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at CLT underscore golf guy. Hey, for a golf nut, there's not much better than U.S. Open Week, especially when it is contested on the West Coast. Even better, Pebble Beach Golf Links. Hey, it's our national championship. And for us out east, it's golf in primetime, baby. And high-definition television and Pebble Beach go together like chocolate and peanut butter. This week on the show, of course, we take a deep dive into our country's national championship with two-time U.S. Open champion, World Golf Hall of Famer Curtis Strange. Ron Reed, who for 23 years served as the official starter for the U.S. Open and has written a book about his experiences. And our boots on the ground, if you will, we'll check in with Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer. You know, in the modern era of golf, there are only three men who know the feeling of winning back-to-back U.S. Opens and trying for a third. Ben Hogan, Brooks Koepka this year, and this man, World Golf Hall of Famer Curtis Strange. Curtis, before we start talking about the U.S. Open, I wanted to ask you about this because I was so impressed by the work you did last year when the hurricane came in. Your home basically turned into a center for sending supplies and whatnot, and having grown up in the Gulf Coast and knowing the devastation of hurricanes, I know that recovery doesn't happen overnight. So my first question to you is, how is the hurricane recovery 8 months later, 9 months later?
Well, it's on the surface. It looks like it's moving along pretty nicely. But you know, as well as everybody who's ever been in the middle of one, the devastation is still there.
Yeah.
Down east, where there are lowlands and people, you know, fighting insurance, fighting homes, trying to get back in their homes, trying to repair or rebuild. And in many cases, they can't afford that. So it's still there, much like other parts of the country that have been hit in the last couple, two or three or four years. But, you know, people are strong. They come together to survive, and that's what we're doing.
Great. Just wanted to ask, because I was really blown away by the work you and Sarah did last year. It was very, very touching. Curtis Strange, Hall of Famer and Fox broadcaster, is our guest taking dead aim. Before we go any further, I want to talk about something last year that blew me away. I don't know if it was a year or 2 years ago. You and I had the conversation about when you won your second consecutive U.S. Open, and that put you on the list with Hogan in the modern era. That was it. That's the list. And I asked you if you had ever heard from Hogan or what he had to say to you. And I was surprised. I guess I shouldn't have been, knowing what I know about the man, but I was surprised that you said he never reached out to you, never said a word, and you never had contact with him. And as Koepka was nearing the end at Shinnecock last year, I turned to my wife and I said, this is not going to take long. Curtis is right there. I'm going to be stunned if he doesn't say something immediately or within a couple of hours if there's not something on Twitter. Well, we didn't have to wait long. I don't think he had taken 20 steps off the green. You were there covering it for Fox. You spoke to him. You embraced him. He, of course, in the moment, there's no way he understood the gravity of what happened. But you and I both know that down the line, he's going to look back at that moment and truly appreciate it. What did you say to Brooks at that moment?
You know, well played. There's not much to say. You know, just the handshake and the embracement, it says it all. You know, he's in his world. He's just won a second consecutive U.S. Open, or it just won a U.S. Open. And hard fought on a tough golf course. You're almost numb. And so I just wanted to get it out of the way. I thought about what, when, and where, because I didn't want to bother him. People are going to, you know, circle him immediately. But I knew where to stand, and I knew how to get to him. And then shortly after that, I got to interview him on Fox, so that was kind of fun. But during the interview, I asked him, Charlie, and I don't know if I ever told you this, is that during the interview, I said, do you know what this means? And he said, no. And a lot of people took that as, disrespect maybe, but I actually thought it was perfect because I didn't know what it meant 30 years ago.
How could you?
No, you can't. And you're in the moment and whatever that means, but you're in the moment and you're not thinking about anything other than yourself. And so, and as I've said many, many times, the longer it got for me as being the last guy, the more it meant. So when you're in the middle of your career, in the prime of your career, and you do something like went back to back, it's great and it's nice and you're happy and successful and you're accomplished a lot, but you move on to the next week. You know, these are professionals. They're doing this every week, so you move on. And but if it's 30 years for him, it'll mean a whole lot more than it did last year, and it was the perfect response.
He's now won two consecutive U.S. Opens at Erin Hills and at Shinnecock, two completely different golf courses. I look back at the two you won and Brookline, and then just, in my opinion, the only thing nastier than Rochester in the winter is Rochester at Oak Hill. Just nasty, nasty place.
Well said.
I mean, I'm sorry. My dad tells a story about going to school at Rochester. He came down for classes one morning in his freshman year. There was a thermometer in direct sunlight. And it was a North Carolina boy, and he looked at it said minus 20, and he said not today, and walked right back upstairs. I mean, even in the best of times, it's terrible. He's coming off two consecutive.
Well, let me interrupt you. I went up for the press day to play 18 holes and visit the press and spend a day with him for, you know, defending.
Right.
And it snowed 4 inches.
Classic.
So we went in the clubhouse and we bowled. They had a couple of bowling alleys, so we bowled, did the press conference. It was actually quite fun.
How great is that? What was your mindset when you were coming back that next year? Did you feel like, okay, I'm going to do what hadn't been done since the turn of the century? We're going to go for number three. Or were you somewhat mentally exhausted after 2 years of doing it?
You know, I was never, you know, the type of player that stood on the first tee. I was never that good. I was never good enough to stand on the first tee and say, this is my week, or I'm feeling, you know, whatever. You get on the first tee and you're prepared, you're rested, and you go play golf. And if momentum takes over and you make a few putts and hit a couple of shots, and it, you know, every round and every day has to build on itself. And so that's the way I went about it. And, you know, I wasn't playing – well, actually, I was playing well. I was playing decent. But it only takes 4 days, and you can find something quickly. And I played really solid the first 2 days. And I've just given myself a chance. But leading up to it, you know, there was a lot of – you know, busy noise, and that takes its toll. I mean, and I enjoyed every minute of it, but there's a lot of press, a lot of people asking about it. And so the only piece I ever really got was playing golf at a golf tournament on the course. And I thought about it a lot because I think I was just stupid enough to think I might have a chance to do this. And I like Medina. I went into Medina for the first and only time in my life. I went in there a couple weeks early and played a round of golf just to familiarize myself with it. And then I shot 68 on Saturday, and I gave myself a chance, and that's all I can ask to do. And that was exciting. It didn't come off, and, you know, realistically, that was probably the way it was going to happen because I was two shots back and behind a lot of good players, and I was going to have to shoot a good score. But anyway, it was exciting times. And, you know, I think it's a little different for Brooks in the respect that he's also won two PGAs. I believe he's number one in the world. He's the guy right now. And I don't know if I was so much the guy. I was just, you know, I was just trying to play good golf and represent, you know, and defend well. And so Brooks is so dominant and in the middle of some fantastic play, and he's the ultimate modern-day player with strength and accuracy and touch and a good, good attitude and mentality. I think he's kind of cool hand Luke. I love the way he goes about it. So anyway, I think he's got probably a better chance than I had because of his length. And But it was exciting times. And like I said, all you can do is give yourself a chance, you know, on the weekend.
I love talking with Curtis Strangman. He talks about not being the guy. We're talking about the PGA Tour leading money winner in 85, 87, 88, the player of the year in 88, two-time U.S. Open champion and World Golf Hall of Famer, Curtis Strange. Not quite the guy. He's our guest taking dead aim. I like,
well, I'm giving you a hard time. No, no, but I say that, and you know, for our listeners, I say that in all honesty because, you know, Seve was still playing at the top of his game, and Norman was at the top of his game, and Watson was still playing so well, and, you know, hell, Jack had just won the Masters in 86. So we had five or six guys, Sandy Lyle, you know, Ian Woosnam, you know, just we had a lot of guys that were certainly capable of doing what I was doing. You know, I made a putt here and there more than they did at certain times, but they certainly, you know, beat my ass plenty of times too. So it was I was playing well, but there was a handful of guys that really could really, really go too.
I like the term you used a minute ago, the dizzy noise surrounding you playing or going for that third consecutive U.S. Open. I don't know how that could possibly compare with today's climate with all the social media and the golf channels and the 24-hour sports and news cycle. That dizzying noise, I imagine, could get deafening for Brooks Koepka next week.
You know, when I said a moment ago that I like the way he goes about it, I don't think he looks at a lot of that. And I think, first of all, we older generation set don't know what it's like really because we didn't grow up with that. And they grew up with it, so that's all part of their life. I think they know how to get away from it, in social media. I don't think they turn on. Remember, when I was doing well, now let's just reminisce for it. When I was doing well, there was still, you know, basically three channels on TV in 88.
Right.
Okay. ESPN was just in its infancy. There was no social media. There was none of this, none of that. And so it was clickers were barely around, you know, that kind of thing. So maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit. So there wasn't as much going on then as it is now. But, you know, there was still plenty of it. There was still plenty of press around. There was still plenty of people. There was still plenty of, you know, excited fans. So it was, in our way, a lead up to our third straight U.S. Open was quite busy.
I mentioned your U.S. Open wins at Brookline and at Oak Hill. Those are two USGA courses, as are Wingfoot, Oakmont, et cetera. But, you know, their crown jewel is arguably Pebble Beach. And I know that you've probably been out there, if not twice, definitely once, for Fox scouting, getting ready for next week. What is your assessment of Pebble Beach at this time?
It's going to be, I think, back to a more likened U.S. Open to past. Heavy rough weather, we don't know whatever happens at Pebble Beach. The greens are so small there that they'll be firm and fast, but you have to be careful getting them too firm and fast now. There's a lot of slope and they're very small. I think it's going to be a tough test. I certainly expect 5, 6, or 7 in the par to be shot because these guys are the best players in the world, and they're so long. And if somebody drives it well, there's no reason you can't make birdies there. With that said, it so much depends on the weather, but it's going to be a good test. Pebble is not the longest course in the world, which I think brings in a few more people that have the opportunity to play and win. But still, there's no substitute for strength. And DJ and Brooks and Rory and the likes are so, Jason and all the top players, they're top players for a lot of reasons. They're incredibly talented, but they also have the strength to rely on. And strength shows its face in so many different ways, length off the tee. Now, that might be negated a little bit because Pebble not the longest. But even if it's not the longest, you still come in with shorter irons and hard to hard greens. The ability to hit out of the rough, the ability to play in wind and weather if it does come in, it's certainly an advantage to have.
Curtis Strange, World Golf Hall of Famer and Fox broadcaster, is our guest taking dead aim. the USGA has taken some heat, and rightfully so, in the past few years in terms of course setup and course selection, to be quite frank. They can't go wrong with the course selection at Pebble Beach. And I was really encouraged by something last week watching the Women's Open, and I wonder if you think this is something that might continue. I've had a problem with the USGA becoming obsessed with the number 280 and even par to their detriment. And last week, I thought the setup at the Country Club of Charleston was fantastic. I thought it was fair. And it seemed for the first time in a long time, I didn't think the USGA was obsessed with someone finishing at even par, one under or one over. And I thought the golf was a lot better. You say that perhaps Pebble Beach will harken back to a classic U.S. Open setup. But do you think that the USGA might, going forward, not be as obsessed with that number?
Well, they have a different setup man. Mike Davis, the CEO of the USGA, was also the setup man, and he was the one in the last 10 or 12 years that has changed the setup that we used to know. I was encouraged early on, but then it kind of got, I think, a little bit tricked up, quirky, whatever. You know, U.S. Opens are supposed to be the toughest test in the world because it's our U.S. Open. And Arnold Palmer told me years ago you should be exhausted Sunday night. Feel like you've been through a, 15-round match. And he's right. But we want tough, but the players want fair as well. And that's where they've crossed the line a little bit over the years. It's become unfair. And don't tell me about mulligans and making a few mistakes here and there. You're not afforded a mistake. You're setting up a championship golf course that's your national championship. And the other championships in this world don't have the similar problems, that you guys have. So hopefully this goes with no controversy at all. And let me just say, from a TV standpoint, it's something that we don't want to cover either. Phil Mickelson hitting a moving ball last year, DJ putt rolling on the green, things like that. It takes away from what we want to do as TV people. So not only do the fans not want to see it, but sometimes it does make for good TV. But I don't think the key is that you want Pebble Beach and the players to be the two stars, not anything else. And that's what I want for the first time in 3 or 4 years.
Pebble Beach can give you winners like Jack Nicklaus and Tiger Woods. It can give you winners that are grinders like Graham McDowell and Tom Kite. If you were to place a bet right now, do we have a Nicklaus Woods type winner or a grinder kind of winner?
I think it depends on the weather, Charlie. I think if the weather gets gnarly, it could be a grinder, which is much the case in both Graham McDowell and Tom Kite. The weather turned really, really cruddy with Graham McDowell late both days on the weekend, I believe. And what happens is even maybe some better players fall by the wayside because they can't handle it. And then Tom Kite, of course, it blew 30 on Sunday. And I played that Sunday, in the middle of the pack. And let me just tell you, it blew. my gosh. And so, it just all depends on the weather. And as a bit of a cynic sitting here at 64 years old, I kind of hope the weather comes in. It makes for good TV. It's more for us to talk about. It's exciting. And, you'll see great shots and you'll see people struggle. And that makes for good storylines. And, but I still think right now, and we've seen it in recent years, strength is showing its face in championship trophies. It's hard to overcome. For instance, Graham McDowell versus Brooks Koepka. Graham McDowell has given up 30 and 40 yards off the tee. It's hard to beat somebody that puts it in the fairway. He can, but he better be Hogan-esque. He better be straight as an arrow and meaner than a snake and make everything he looks at. But that's asking a lot. So we'll just have to wait and see. Predicting now, you go with the favorites, you go with who's playing well. But how that gets ripped up and thrown out the car window after the first 9 holes on Thursday morning. So you just never know. But it's good to talk about.
Get you out of here on this. Curtis Strange, World Golf Hall of Famer and Fox broadcaster, our guest taking Dead Aim. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you. I was blown away by Tiger at the Masters. I thought it was one of the best moments in sports, period, in the last 5 years. You've been with Tiger since the very, very, very beginning. First, I want to get your thoughts, what went through your head as you were watching what he was doing on the back nine at Augusta, and then your thoughts as far as Tiger, how could he be in the mix at Pebble?
He could very well be in the mix at Pebble. He didn't play well on the PGA, but you got to think about it. You got to say, well, he didn't play well late. But I think it's such a hangover from his win at the Masters. And I say that because my take was fantastic at the Masters. He was there. I mean, he was there. He put himself in position. Two or three of the other guys didn't play well, which very well could have just beat him. But he won. It doesn't matter how. And the scene of him not wanting to leave the last green and the scene with his family was nice, but when he walked with his son after hugging his family through the fans to the clubhouse and was pumping his fists and yelling and high-fiving people, we have never seen him do that ever. And that showed to me one thing, how much he enjoyed this, and the true emotions were coming out, and certainly there was a hangover for a couple weeks or so. Should have been. I'm glad there was. It shows that he really cares and how excited he was, and I just thought it was good TV. And I don't root for anybody. I try to be as impartial as I possibly can doing TV. It's what I have to do. But you do root for the story a little bit. And the story early Sunday morning was Tiger Woods.
In his attempt to win his third consecutive U.S. Open, going into that final round, Curtis Strange was only two shots out of the lead. I wonder if Brooks Koepka will make it that interesting, or maybe even more so. And when we return, starting the U.S. Open, From Shinnecock to Pebble Beach is the name of the book, and author Ron Reed takes Dead Aim at his experiences on the first tee of our national championship, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. For more than two decades, Ron Reed was the official starter on the first tee for the U.S. Open. He's chronicled his experiences in the book, Starting the U.S. Open, From Shinnecock to Pebble Beach, and we had the chance to speak earlier this week. Ron, so I've been fascinated by this job, and as I was thinking about it, I almost wonder if it's one of the reasons I got into broadcasting in the first place. Let me explain. My earliest experiences of sports was going to Houston Astro games, and whenever I would go to the Astrodome, there was a great in-building announcer, and we had a player named Jose Cruz, and he would announce it in left field, Jose Cruz, and the place would just go crazy with the Cruz. And I remember thinking, even as a little boy, this is the greatest job in the world. This guy knows that every time he does this, people are going to go insane, and he's kind of a part of the story here. And I've been fortunate enough to be able to do some of that work with the local hockey team here in Charlotte, and I realize what you did is different, but it's a great job to announce these guys, isn't it?
It was the dream job, and the one I never sought. I was the player liaison, a role that Jason Gore is now filling with USGA. But I dealt with the players. I met them at registration. I got to know them one-on-one. And that's really what I write about in this book. But, it's so true. It is a dream come true.
At what point do you get the final list from the USGA of all the competitors? And I ask because of all the names, and there's like 150, 160 names, we'll just throw that out. How many are you actually sweating the pronunciation of?
Very few. What I did was I learned to meet the players at registration and to phonetically spell out. And they normally would start coming in on Sunday prior to the US Open. So I would sit down And I would say Jose Maria Olazabal genetically. And then I would circulate that to all the media, so the TV, radio, et cetera, had it the same way. The hard part, we used to do the hometowns of foreigners, which I think they still should. And in the case of Jose, his was Fuenterrubia, Spain, and he had to train me. He literally trained me on the tee at Hazeltine to say that. So I struggled mostly with the hometowns of foreigners, but I got the names down pretty well.
Yeah, it made you just long for Erie, Pennsylvania.
Ron, the hardest for me was Massachusetts.
Ron Reed is the author of Starting the U.S. Open from Shinnecock to Pebble Beach. You were the first tee announcer for how many years?
Just 23.
Just 23.
Yep, 1986, and then I was part-time in 87, 88, and then from 89 on through 2010.
I don't care how little people think of the work that's being done of announcing these players, and having done a lot of this work myself, I know this to be true. Keeping your throat and your voice lubricated to do this over, and I'm guessing, are you doing this over an 8-hour period approximately?
No, it was a little more than that.
A little bit more than 8 hours. That's a real trick.
I would drink lots of water. And by the way, I did use the restroom. Ivor Robeson, my counterpart in Scotland at the Open Championship, they said he never used the restroom. Well, trust me, I did.
You know, that was always legendary about Ivor, and I'm glad that you brought up his name. But I always saw, you know, facilities right by the tee box at the Open Championship, just like they are nearby at the U.S. Open. And I always wondered, well, why didn't he go? It's not like he doesn't have 8 to 10 minutes between tee times. What's going on here?
Well, I watched him closely in 2010, and guess what? He did disappear for a bit. I'm guessing maybe he just got a banger or something. But, he disappeared for a little bit.
Starting the U.S. Open from Shinnecock to Pebble Beach. It's a great book to pick up for Father's Day. Ron Reed, the author, is our guest, taking dead aim. All right, so you started at Shinnecock. You've been to Pebble Beach 23 years in between. I know that you have something nice to say about every location, but you're human. You have favorites. Give me your top five favorite locations.
Wow. You're tough. Obviously, Pebble Beach, I've lived there for 25 years. I walk it 5 days a week now with my wonderful dog. I know it the best. And, you know, the beauty of Pebble Beach is spectacular. It's not the hardest of the golf courses. I think the hardest, and I love Oakmont in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And I have so many wonderful memories. I tell about Arnold's last U.S. Open there at Oakmont. I love Shinnecock. I think Shinnecock Hills is number one on the U.S. Open Rota. I loved it. Oakland Hills, fantastic golf course. Torrey Pines, I would put up there in the top five in difficulty. So if I hit five.
Really? So you have Torrey Pines ranked up there in difficulty with some of those others, because I really consider, you know, Oakmont and Shinnecock to be maybe, when they're set up for the Open, the hardest two courses on planet Earth.
I would agree with it. Probably, I think Oakmont would be the hardest set up for an Open.
Ron, as a lover of the game of golf and your involvement with the USGA all those years, you bring up Arnold's last U.S. Open at Oakmont, and I remember seeing things in the press room that I never saw before. You never see the press give a standing ovation to anybody. They were so moved by it. As someone who loves the game and knew what Arnold meant to the game, much less being in his backyard there at Oakmont, was it a tough thing for you to keep it together that last time that you're announcing Arnold Palmer?
It wasn't so hard to keep it together. Well, the story's in the book. He was almost late to the tee, and I must confess, there were two trees that have since been removed. But I envisioned the possibility that I might be hanging from one of them if I said to Arnold Palmer, "You got to have two strokes for being late." But it was very, very emotional, and I think people will enjoy the story, especially the lecture that I gave him. Why, I don't know. The second day, his last round, he arrived early, and for some silly reason, I decided to lecture him on lateness, and we had a very good laugh. So There was only one. There'll always only be one Arnold Palmer.
I imagine this is another story in the book based on a tweet that you sent out this weekend that I was fascinated to find out about. You touched on briefly in correspondence to someone to Olympia Fields in 2003. Jim Furyk won that U.S. Open, but for me, I will always remember that being Bruce Edwards' last U.S. Open on the bag for Tom Watson, and they had sort of a magical round and a half where they were actually in contention, and it was marvelous. I believe you touched on the fact that that may have been the only time that the caddy was a bigger story than the player.
I think you're right. And the television people at Fox actually visited my home and interviewed me about that one story. And it has to do with the flag from the 17th hole at Pebble Beach, 1982, when Tom chipped in with Bruce on the bag. And I had the flag. I personally had the flag for 23 years until it dawned on me that maybe I shouldn't have it. And so I presented it on the tee there the final round because Bruce was such a big story. And the rest I'll let for people to read. But that was a very, very emotional, special moment. I must say, Bruce and I shed a tear right there on the first tee.
How is it that you came into possession of that flag?
The flag made its way to the USGA office the following morning, and I was there, and it ended up in my back pocket.
So. it hopped in your back pocket, mysteriously.
Yeah. I threw it into a box, and every once in a while I'd come to it and I'd say, what am I going to do with this thing? And it being Tom's last Open, I thought, I'll go and get it signed, and I'll keep it. And then the story got bigger and bigger and bigger with Tom leading and Bruce health situation and the rest I'll leave because but I think readers will find it interesting.
The book is called Starting the U.S. Open from Shinnecock to Pebble Beach. The author is Ron Reed. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. You mentioned Ivor Robeson, your counterpart with the RNA and the Open Championship earlier. I was always intrigued towards the end of Ivor's career, the last couple of years, the camaraderie that had sort of developed between some of the players and Ivor and the way that he took to pronouncing some of their names. Like, I'll never forget the way he says, Rory McIlroy. Did you find in all of your years that you developed somewhat of a relationship, maybe too strong a word, but a camaraderie, a familiarity with some of these players, and there were, you know, hey, good to see you again exchanges?
I would say I developed, I was lucky because for 30 years as player liaison, I would sit down often one-on-one with them, and I got to know them and often their families quite well. I developed favorites. I gotta be honest. You know, Tom Lehman was always in the hunt, and Steve Stricker, and David Toms, and, you know, wonderful guys. And you know, deep down, I hope that they would pull through and become U.S. Open champions.
I believe Tom Lehman played in the final group 3 out of 4 years and never closed the deal at the U.S. Open. For you to have had a closeness with him, that had to be somewhat heartbreaking for you.
There's a story in there at Oakland Hills that I think people will warm to about, and it said so much about Tom Lehman as a person. He got into a situation where late in the game, he called what could have been a penalty on himself playing with his friend Steve Jones, and I'll leave the rest there, but. Well, I think you'll find it interesting because deja vu, 1 month later, guess what? He won the Open Championship at Royal Lytham, and there's a story to that as well. But it said so much about the integrity of Tom Lehman.
Ron Reed is the author of Starting the U.S. Open from Shinnecock to Pebble Beach. Great Father's Day gift idea. Ron, we're at the 20th anniversary of Payne Stewart and Pinehurst, and being here in Charlotte and my son playing competitive junior golf, and I'm down at Pinehurst all the time. We always go see the statue. It's almost a good luck thing. If you're going to Pinehurst, you have to go see the statue before you do anything else. What are your memories of 1999 and Pinehurst, and specifically that final day with Payne Stewart?
Well, he gave it a three. He came to me on the first tee playing with Phil, and he said, have you got a pair of scissors? And I didn't know why he wanted scissors. And the bottom line is, his caddy, we found some in the tennis club there and got him a pair of scissors. And I'll leave the rest of that one out. Then I went to Starting, and as you know, there's a church nearby.
Yes.
And the chimes often perhaps interfered with the announcement. Well, I went to introduce their group, and guess what was playing? Amazing Grace.
Wow.
And I said, and I checked this out. I called the church, and later, just recently, and I decided to pause and let that play out before their introduction. And lastly, when he finished, Tom Meeks, who was in charge of the event, gave him a big hug, and he turned around and he said to me, "Can you get champagne for the press room?" He was going to pull a Tony Lima. Yeah. I looked at him and I said, "You know, I'm not sure I can pull that off." Well, guess what? I couldn't. They couldn't come up with enough champagne for 3,000 people.
So let me just fill in the blanks for Ron Reed's story here. Ron is the one who supplied him the scissors that cut off the sleeves of the rain jacket. And for all of us that have short sleeve rain gear now, we're talking to the man who is the reason for it. Ron Reed is the author. Starting the U.S. Open from Shinnecock to Pebble Beach is the book. He's our guest taking Dead Aim. I'll get you out of here on this. As someone who will never have the opportunity to step on the first tee at the U.S. Open, would it be too much to have you announce me just one time?
Well, I gotta warm my voice.
All right, I'm from Monroe, North Carolina.
Monroe,
North Carolina.
All right, I can handle that, ladies and gentlemen. This is the 12 o'clock starting time from Monroe, North Carolina. Charlie Nance, play away, please.
Yeah. Talk about a great Father's Day gift for the golfing dad in your life. Just out this past Tuesday, it's called Starting the U.S. Open from Shinnecock to Pebble Beach. That's author Ron Reed. Oh, and if you purchase the book at ronreed.com, Ron will personally inscribe it with your official first tee announcement. That's ronreed.com. How cool is that? And up next, our boots on the ground at Pebble. From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, Ron Green Jr. takes Dead Aim at this United States Open Championship, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.
We're taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors. Ron Green Jr. of the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer is on the beat at Pebble Beach this week, and we had the chance to speak prior to the start of Thursday's first round. So, Ron, I want to start with telling you I'm not near as mad and jealous at you as I was early in the year when you were standing in the surf in Hawaii tweeting me pictures of what you were looking at as the sun was setting while we were talking. But the picture you sent out on Tuesday, that was really nice of the sun setting at Pebble Beach.
Well, truth be told, it was a couple miles from Pebble Beach, actually from my hotel room balcony. So
even worse, that was your hotel?
I could throw my socks in the water if I wanted to. I won't do that, but I could do that if I wanted to. So, yeah, it's nice, and the weather out here has been terrific, and now it's tournament time, and going to get back to being properly Pebble Beach. But it's if you've ever been here, you know what a gorgeous place it is. It's a little tricky to get around tournament week, but it's great treat to be here.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say how great it looks. The camera people aren't even in game mode right now, but as you're seeing all the shots from Pebble, it just looks breathtaking, and the forecast is unbelievable in terms of greatness. So weather should not be a factor. Maybe a slight marine layer in the morning, but it should be just optimum conditions, yes?
Yeah, I mean, that's part of the one of the many good things about having the Open here is traditionally in June, they don't get much rain. I mean, I was in San Francisco Sunday playing golf, and it was in the low 90s, which was, you know, they had the excessive heat warnings out and all that stuff, which, of course, being from where we're from, like, huh, funny. And, you know, it was a nice day. And but, of course, it did happen to be low 90s at a place where you were not allowed to wear shorts, so it got a little steamy. But the weather and, you know, the marine layer kind of comes and goes. Hopefully it doesn't come in enough that it forces play to be stopped for any length of time. But it should be, as it unfolds, look and feel and just be the kind of U.S. Open. When you think U.S. Open Pebble Beach, we should get just what we're hoping for.
I know it may be kind of a drag for you because you may be on East Coast deadlines, but from a viewing standpoint, I love it when the U.S. Open is on the West Coast, especially at Pebble. You know, you got guys like Tiger, whose first round was at 5 o'clock Eastern time on Thursday, stretching into prime time. It's just, it's hard to beat being able to go home and watch golf at Pebble in prime time.
Yeah, I guess I'm as happy as I am to be here, and I think this is 22 U.S. Opens in a row or something, but there's something to be said for if I were home sitting there with a nice refreshing beverage and probably more snacks than I need to eat and just watching them play into the night. And, I think that's one of the charms of the West Coast U.S. Opens that for the viewers back on the East, it's primetime golf and doesn't get much better than the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. One of the big changes from previous years to now is who's in charge of course setup. Mike Davis, and rightfully so, has taken a lot of heat in the past several years for some of the mistakes the USGA has made. The handoff comes to John Bodenhammer. He actually lucks out. I don't think it's possible for you to screw up Pebble Beach if you're the USGA, although they might try. But I have not heard the vetching and complaining from the players about the setup. In fact, I've heard nothing but raves about the golf course this week.
Yeah, I think it's been sort of unanimous praise. Then again, early in the week at Shinnecock last year, there was a lot of that too. It obviously changed on the weekend, and they admitted their mistake. In their press conference this week, they talked about, you know, we messed up with water on the greens on Saturday at Shinnecock, and they have told the players here, depending on how the weather goes and what could potentially happen with course conditions, that they may syringe greens in the middle of rounds. They want to, you know, avoid what has happened in the past. Yeah, John Bodenhammer said they have told them of some alternate teeing grounds, depending on what the conditions are. There's new tees at 9, new tees that brought the old tee back down on the water at 10, changing the angle. So they'll give them some different options. You know, it's not a long golf course, almost quaint by modern standards, 7,075 yards. Like, really? That's all? So, you remember Erin Hills was 7,800 plus. So, but I think, you know, the players are no complaints. They love what they see. It's sort of a proper U.S. Open. Fairways are the same width they were in 2010 when Graham McDowell won, and they sort of used that as a blueprint. They tweaked a couple things here and there, but it came off well in 10, and so they're trying to duplicate that again.
Well, and they just had the AM out there last year, so that should have given them something to go by as well. Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. You brought up the USGA. An interesting announcement that's come about, and one that I think is going to help things going down the line, is the, I don't know if it's a new position or just a new person in the position, and that's Jason Gore, who we all love as a person and remember from 2005. At Pinehurst, is now sort of the player liaison with the USGA. There's going to be an open communication between the players and the USGA, whereas in the past I feel like there's been a wall between them. What has been the reaction from the players on Jason and this announcement?
Well, I think they like it because everybody felt like everybody knew and liked Jason Gore. I mean, he's just one of those guys you can't not like. And in fact, his first week out in this role on tour was at Quail Hollow during the Wells Fargo. And John Bodenhammer mentioned it in his presser, and he said, particularly as related to rules, if players had questions or mentioned anything to Jason, that Jason turned around and called the office, whether talking to Thomas Pagel or whatever, and the USGA reached back out to the player directly and talked to him about whatever the subject is, trying to build that bridge, understanding there's been a gap between the two groups, and, you know, it doesn't instantly solve everything, but at least it's a it's an effort to sort of streamline things. And if, you know, player may not always agree with what USGA has decided, but at least they get the explanation and an understanding of why.
Ron, there's two great stats in golf. One is no one has ever won the par three contest and gone on to win the Masters. And the other is no one has ever won the week before the United States Open Golf Championship and gone on to win the United States Open Golf Championship. That being said, what Rory did last weekend in Canada was most impressive. I know you and I have both said on many occasions, regardless of what the overall world golf rankings say, when Rory McIlroy is firing on all cylinders, no one makes the game look easier. And he is far and away the number one player in the world. Shooting 64-61 in Canada last week proved that. All of it being said, what are your thoughts on his chances of breaking that sort of interesting stat?
Well, he sort of did his secretariat impersonation. I think it the Canadian Open just took it and kept going and going and let everybody else come in there behind him somehow. I mean, he's a guy who, it's hard to believe, it's been whatever, 5 years almost since he's won a major championship, because he was just, you know, knocking them down one after the other there for a time. He is, when he gets it going, it almost seems like nobody gets it going quite like he does. And you know, here at Pebble Beach, putting and wedge play is going to be critical. Wedge play is, you know, not his strongest suit, he'll tell you that. But, you know, he putted beautifully at Canada. And if he can, he's such a confident player, if he can get himself in it early and make some putts and sort of keep what he had in Canada going, I mean, this could be a perfect place for him. I mean, the pedigree of U.S. Open champions at Pebble Beach from Nicklaus and Watson and Tiger and all that, I mean, he fits it perfectly. I mean, it's a golf course that, you know, guys are going to hit four drivers, five drivers around. So it negates in some way his greatest asset, because he can drive it like nobody else. But still with his power, he's still going to be able to have some shorter clubs in. And, you know, the list of picks doesn't go very far before his name comes up, if it goes beyond one.
Speaking of list of picks, at the top of everyone's list has to be the two-time defending U.S. Open Championship. In the modern era, there's Hogan, there's Strange, and there's Koepka. That's it. That's the list as far as winning back-to-back Opens. Near the turn of the 20th century, Willie Anderson won three in a row. I think for the first time in my lifetime, I'm looking at a guy going, I'm not going to be even the remote bit surprised if he wins his third U.S. Open in a row.
Yeah, I mean, people keep asking, who are you picking? I'm like, well, you don't have to hit me over the head with a sledgehammer. I mean, look who keeps winning all the majors. Let's start with him. Let's start with Brooks Koepka. You know, of course, it was funny when he pointed out that he saw the Fox promo about the U.S. Open.
I was going to ask you about this. What the hell was Fox thinking?
Well, they did four commercials, including one solely about Brooks Koepka, I think. But and he was in all of those. But so it was pointed out to him there was one without him. And sure, how do you do a promo for the U.S. Open when a guy's trying to make history and you don't even include him? You know, I would hate to be the person who had to explain that one. You know, he's a guy, he can win anywhere he wants, anywhere he plays. I mean, he's got he talks about those motivational things. I think, fine, maybe that does fire him up. I've never been a whole big believer in the whole, you know, bulletin board material and all that. But whatever works is working for him, and he has such a strong belief in what he's doing and how he does it. And, you know, he's just made for major championships. What happened at Bethpage when he had the big lead and nearly lost it? You know, as in his words, shock and awe there for about an hour when suddenly he's made four bogeys in a row. And that may help him now, because if he gets in that situation again, now he's been through it and come out of it and still won. So, I mean, you know, it's like that old Bruce Springsteen song, Tougher Than the Rest. That may be his theme song.
Ron Green Jr. with the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, our guest taking Dead Aim. Let's talk about a couple of other names. Dustin Johnson has won a couple of AT&T Pebble Beach Pro-Ams out there. He had the U.S. Open on his racket in 2010, to use a tennis expression, until he blew up on the second hole on Sunday and lost that lead that I thought was insurmountable the way he was playing. Again, this is a guy you're not going to have to go far down on the list before you come to his name.
No, I mean, built for this place, built for any place, I mean, the way he plays. And, you know, given that you're not going to hit drivers as often here as other places, and maybe have a few more wedges in. You know, we've talked over and over about what he did to sort of transform himself as a player and the work he did with his wedges. So that's something that's a real strength of his. And then, you know, his coach, Butch Harmon's out here instead of long distance. I mean, working hands-on with him here. So, I mean, he loves this place. He plays AT&T Pro-Am. It's just no shock at all if Dustin finally picks up another major championship here.
Get you out of here on a couple of things. Let's hit on a couple of California kids, and they're not so much kids anymore, but they sure know how to win around Pebble Beach, and that's Phil Mickelson and Tiger Woods. I watched a little bit of Tiger hitting on the range before the tournament, and my God, he looked good.
Yeah, I mean, he's saying the right things. You know, he's been sort of prepping for this one. There's a different vibe to him being here than there was at Bethpage. You didn't feel it at Bethpage. Even after all the enthusiasm and excitement of the Masters, it just that fell flat. It was not his week, and you could tell it early on. But this, I mean, it's hard to escape the memory or shadow or whatever you want to call it from 2000 when he won here by 15. I mean, that was the greatest performance ever. And sure, they've played another U.S. Open here since then, and he was a factor in it for a while then. But I think he's, you know, these are the moments he lives for, he plays for. And, you know, he's got that opportunity that we thought he might never have again. Nothing would surprise you if Tiger did it again here. I mean, it's going to be hard. He's, you know, got to keep it out of the rough, and he's got to make some putts. He doesn't putt it quite as well as he used to, but nobody will think their way around the golf course better than Tiger.
This is really Phil's last decent chance to close the career Grand Slam, don't you think?
I think so. Now, we could talk about Wingfoot next year, where he was arguably a tee shot away from winning his U.S. Open, and they're going back there. But no, I think this is the one. I think Phil probably senses that. I mean, you know, he's getting on up there, and age and chances are closing down. And, of course, he won here in February, but a totally different golf course setup. You know, everything about it's different. And but I mean, you go to a place where you got good vibes. I mean, it helps. Sometimes you wonder if Phil just overthinks things, over preps, over analyzes. I don't know. I think if he can just sit back and let it happen, not try to force it to happen, he has a chance. But sometimes Phil tries to force the issue, and that can come back to bite you. Then again, he's finished second 6 times, so he does know how to play U.S. Opens.
And finally, I looked at the calendar, and lo and behold, it's been 20 years since Payne Stewart at Pinehurst number 2 in 1999. Real quick, what are some things that stand out still to this day in your mind from that win?
Well, first thing I think about is how unseasonable the weather was, and standing out there on the 18th hole as he finished that Sunday afternoon, it was chilly and damp and not at all like what mid-June in Pinehurst usually is, but it was the perfect atmosphere, and it just, I mean, it was one of the great Sundays in U.S. Open history, from Duval to, you know, Steve Stricker was up there, Tiger, I mean, Phil, Payne Stewart. It was just a great finish to a tournament that, you know, it was just massive for the state of North Carolina to get that tournament there, and then to have it come off the way it did. And then you had all these characters in it, and then you had one of the most memorable finishes ever. It's on the short list of probably the most memorable U.S. Opens.
Happy Father's Day to you, Ron.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it, John.
From the Global Golf Post and Charlotte Observer, that's Ron Green Jr. Hey, I'd also like to thank Ron Reed, author of Starting the U.S. Open from Shinnecock to Pebble Beach. Again, a great Father's Day gift idea. And World Golf Hall of Famer Curtis Strange for their time and insight this week. A reminder, should you just be catching the last little bit of the show, wonder what all we've covered today, no worries. Just subscribe to the Taking Dead Aim podcast at Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, BPod Studio, Spotify, all the usual podcast outlets, and it will automatically download to the device of your choice. Additionally, a great source of constant golf updates is our Facebook page. Be sure to like us on Facebook. Just search Taking Dead Aim. Featured there right now are links to articles on a Davidson sophomore shooting 57 in competition and numerous points of interest concerning this week's U.S. Open. Hey, U.S. Open Sunday is easy for me to remember. Should be for you, too. It's Father's Day. For many of us, our dads introduced us to this game, and in my case, I think it was key to our relationship as I was growing up. You see, my dad is an artist. And I was a jock. Our Saturday games for Sunday morning shoe shines before church were uninterrupted time we were able to spend together. And time as we all come to realize, is the greatest commodity of all. And I wouldn't trade a second spent with you on the course for the world, Pop. And to my own son, Hogan, it is the honor and thrill of my life to be your dad and to watch you play. Hogan has always been my favorite golfer of all time. It was Ben, but I think you know that now and forevermore, it's you. To all the dads out there, happy Father's Day. A weather-wise, perfect summer weekend in the Carolinas to tee it up and let this game continue to haunt your soul and break your heart. And if you do put a peg in the ground, remember to exhale, swing, pose, and keep it in the short grass. I'm Charlie Nance on Twitter, at @CLT_golfguy, and I'll see you right here next week, Taking Dead Aim, presented by the Charlotte office of RBC Wealth Management, located in the beautiful tree line of South Park and Academy Sports and Outdoors.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.